From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Investigative journalist Scott Woolley is my guest. His latest book is the story of the rise of wireless communications from the telegraph to the internet. It's a fascinating, good read, and it's called The Network, The Battle for the Airwaves and the Birth of the Communications Age. Scott Woolley, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So your book really begins with the story of the Titanic disaster in 1912. How did the Titanic open the door to the growth of the wireless communications industry?
Well, before that, no one really believed that the airwaves had much value. Up until that point, they'd been used to communicate sort of short distances. Marconi had been promising that he'd be able to send telegrams across the Atlantic, but really it only worked for, you know, short-range communications with ships. When the Titanic sank and the two Marconi operators were able to summon help, and you know, that accounting for the 700 some people who were rescued for the ship, all of a sudden Guglielmo Marconi was a global hero, and wireless was seen as no longer a joke.
And until I read your book, it never occurred to me that if there hadn't been wireless on the Titanic, they never would have found the Titanic or the passengers. They would never have known what happened to Titanic.
Absolutely, and you know, only 5 years before were ships really being outfitted with the wireless telegraph. We sort of think of radio as starting in the 20s, but even before that, really the first wireless app was just texting, and so the Titanic was able to text a message for help, and so the people really saw the value of that first app, and then when actual radio came along, AM radio, that of course just multiplied the power of these invisible waves.
Now, as I remember it, William Paley, who was the head of CBS, he got into broadcasting through advertising. He saw it as an opportunity to reach a large number of cigar smokers because his father's in the cigar business.
That's right.
So he created a radio network. Now, in your book, The Network, The Battle for the Airwaves and the Birth of Communications Age, it's not exactly a biography of David Sarnoff, but he's really a major player in your story. How does Sarnoff's story differ from, you know, we remember him as the head of NBC, from his rival, William Paley at CBS?
Well, they had a lot of superficial differences. They were both Jewish, they were both the sons of immigrants, and they both started very successful radio networks. But in fact, they were very, very different. Sarnoff showed up in 1900 as a 10-year-old in Manhattan, and his family was dirt poor, living in the slums. Paley, by the time he was born, his family was relatively well established in the cigar business, and he grew up very well off. So they approached it from very different directions. Paley was interested in the stars and the radio programs, and Sarnoff was interested in the technology and how to lower the cost of communicating. So despite their superficial differences, they were utterly dissimilar as businessmen.
So talk a little bit more about Sarnoff and the other major player in your book, Edwin Armstrong. How did they meet, and what was Armstrong's role?
Well, this was the story that I had heard and some of the books that were written in the 20th century about these two guys had covered this part of the early part of their relationship fairly well. They're about the same age, born in the end of the 19th century. So by the time just before the Titanic, Armstrong has invented or is working on inventing what turns into the first great radio amplifier, and able to amplify incoming radio signals a thousandfold or more. So he hooks up with Sarnoff in the days after the Titanic sinking, and all of a sudden the two of them have this moment where they hook Armstrong's invention to one of Marconi's big antennas that Sarnoff is in control of, and they start hearing wireless signals from the other side of the globe for the first time. So they have this really pivotal moment where they realize these waves can do things that nobody had ever dreamed of, and they sort of first see that together.
And that's when they realized you could send voices and Jack Benny and all that?
Well, people had sent voices a little bit before that, but you couldn't send them very far, and they faded out, and it was really hard to receive. So this just made either sending text messages or voice or music vastly more convenient, because you could do it over much greater distances. So it was this amplifier that was sort of the beginning of the vacuum tube age. These Armstrong's invention was inside of a vacuum tube, and when you hear so much about vacuum tubes from the early part of this century, it's all this sort of circuit that is either creating these radio waves or amplifying them, and that was Armstrong was the heart of that at the beginning of his inventing career.
So what can you define it more? What exactly did Armstrong invent?
So this became the subject of a 25 years of litigation, but to briefly summarize, there was Thomas Edison in 1800 saw that if you, in a, one of his vacuum tubes, that electricity was acting a little funny. This British engineer, John Fleming, figured out how to turn the vacuum tube into kind of a, to turn alternating current into direct current. And what Armstrong really did is to create this feedback circuit, so if an incoming radio wave was very faint, he figured out how to feed it back into each into itself, and all of a sudden you could magnify its power 1,000 times. The very same device inside of a vacuum tube could also start emitting radio waves, so it became sort of the standard radio broadcasting component. So Armstrong was really these vacuum tubes, and this advance that he made of this feedback circuit really created the radio age.
Now, when we think of modern technology and we think of people like Steve Jobs, you know, he's a guy who every single thing was like the next thing, constantly moving forward. But Sarnoff was more of a foot dragger. He didn't want things to move exactly, or were there other people who were trying to stop him from moving forward?
Well, that was really Sarnoff's reputation before I started doing my research and sort of what I figured that he would find. And it was Armstrong's big accusation against his former friend as he went on to develop FM radio. He began to suspect that Sarnoff had had started to intentionally sabotage FM because he wanted to protect what was then NBC's dominant radio network. And so that really created the falling out between the two. And it was always Armstrong's contention that not only was Sarnoff dragging his feet, but he was actively obstructing the better technology, and that he had dedicated himself to sort of sabotaging both the potential of the FM radio industry after World War II and the television industry. And yet he was never quite able to prove it.
Well, what do you believe? Was he sabotaging it?
Well, this is really the story at the heart of the book, and so there's a lot of very compelling evidence on both sides, but what Armstrong really never grappled with was the number of other people who had a motive to sort of do in FM and to limit the amount of power of the television industry, and those were mostly the local station owners. And so if you look at, and there's a number of stories in the book about the crazy regulations that start coming out of Washington that basically crippled the FM radio industry, and they're based on scientific theories that all of the experts say are nonsense, and they have the effect of really ruining FM in the years immediately following World War II. So Armstrong was definitely right that these superior technologies had been crippled, but he failed to really grapple with who would benefit. And it was much less Sarnoff and NBC than it was CBS and especially the local broadcasters.
Well, you know, although I've been a broadcaster for 40 years, I've absolutely no idea how radio works. And I don't know anything about the difference between AM and FM, other than that this is FM. But what is the difference between AM and FM?
Well, I'll tell you specifically, but the big picture idea, and we're really going through this when people talk about going from 4G cell phones to 5G cell phones, technology gets better, and you get better at encoding information into these invisible waves. So that's what's happening when you go from 2G to 3G cell phones and 4G to 5G, and it's what happened when you went from AM to FM. So it's just a different way of encoding information into these waves. Specifically, the old way was by varying the height of the waves and then using that to sort of create a model of a sound wave by altering the height of the invisible electromagnetic waves. FM did it by varying their length. But we can talk more about the technology if you'd like, but the really important idea that Armstrong came up with was there are better ways of encoding information into the air. Let's work on that. Let's work on these radical increases. And it's still what drives wireless technology in the 21st century.
We're chatting with Scott Woolley. His new book, The Network: The Battle for the Airwaves and the Birth of the Communications Age. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. So I guess the myth has always been, and I don't know if it's a myth or what, that, you know, because Sarnoff and Paley had established radio, they didn't want television because, you know, they'd already sold a bunch of radios and they had a radio network to protect.
Well, they certainly had complicated motives, and Sarnoff and RCA especially, because not only did they run NBC, but RCA was the biggest technology manufacturer in the country at the end of World War II. And so Sarnoff had dumped a ton of money into developing television and was really a passionate supporter of that technology. Certainly the AM radio station owners felt very differently. And what ended up happening in television was that many of the radio station owners ended up owning the television stations, either in their town or in other towns, and there was this artificial cap on the number of stations there could be in every town, thus making television far more profitable. To be a local TV station in the late 20th century was about the best business you could possibly imagine. So they really created this world in which competition was limited and profits were incredibly high.
But I guess it's true, and it's still very, very true, and we're feeling it constantly, that as technology moves forward, it buries businesses that were based on older technology.
Absolutely, and I kept finding these quotes from Sarnoff throughout his career making that point in these passionate and often sort of flowery language about how foolish anybody would be to try to resist the waves of new technology that are coming. And that was something his friend Armstrong, and it really is their friendship that is the heart of this story and Armstrong's sense of betrayal, but Armstrong just fundamentally did not believe Sarnoff when Sarnoff kept saying, look, I get it. Technology is going to advance in these radical, amazing ways that we can't fully predict. So let's start backing those and trying to protect the future is foolish. And you can do it for a while and you can be successful for a while, but eventually, you know, you're just going to get moved aside by better technology. So that was always Sarnoff's real bet, and yet it was something his friend couldn't see.
Well, there's a famous episode of What's My Line, the old game show where a person would try to stump a panel of celebrities for $50 or something as to what their job was. And there's an episode where the contestant is a man named Philo Farnsworth. And none of the people on the panel have any idea who he is, even though he's signed his name on the blackboard. And then it's revealed that he's the man who invented television. Was he the man who invented television, and was his invention ripped off?
I would say no and yes, which is probably not the combination of answers you expected. So let me explain. In terms of whether he was the man who invented television, I mean, one of the things that really amazed me as I was going through this was a recognition of how this patent system that was built in the 1800s started to be applied in the 1900s to these technologies that were just way more complicated than anything anybody had ever imagined. So there were hundreds of patents for the wireless telegraph. By the time AM radio came around, there were 4,000 patents that RCA owned just on AM radio, and television was much more complex than that. So Farnsworth invented a small piece of it. People had tried or suggested things like that before, and so it was a significant advance, but it alone did not create a working TV industry, and he needed about a half dozen other sort of critical in terms of the cameras that could capture enough light, and then you would have to turn those light waves and inscribe them on waves that you could send through. I mean, it was incredible. Each component was incredibly complex, and people want to say, who invented television? Well, if there are five different people who invented critical components, what's the answer? So that said, did Farnsworth get enough credit for the piece, the major advance he did make? Probably not.
And, you know, was RCA in the business of ripping off other inventors and their inventions, or...?
Well, I mean, it was created in the wake of World War I. The Marconi Company, the Marconi Wireless Telegraph Company, played a big role in World War I when the cable lines were all cut beneath the Atlantic and people had to send wireless telegraphs. And so after the war, the Navy realized, hey, this is a really important technology. We've got to take it over. We certainly can't let a British company own the biggest American wireless telegraph company. So they turned the Marconi Company into the Radio Corporation of America, RCA. And at the time, the idea was we can't have everybody owning all these different patents and freezing progress. They did this big study, the government did, and so they said we have to have a patent pool, so everybody puts them in the pool, and there's one sort of uniform charge for radio manufacturers or TV manufacturers. So that was the idea of RCA, and then, of course, people would get mad and say, oh, you're doing it wrong, you're charging too much, I'm not getting enough money, that guy's getting too much money. So RCA was created as a patent pool and then was routinely criticized for playing that role over the coming decade.
Of being what it was created to do.
Yeah.
And what role did the telephone company play in all this?
Well, AT&T was one of David Sarnoff's biggest rivals from the early days of his career. After RCA was started, he cut a deal with AT&T so that RCA would take over the radio receiver business, and AT&T, that had been an investor, would break off and they would make the radio transmitters. AT&T thought that was a fine deal. They were used to telephone systems where one person would talk to one person. In fact, a few years later, RCA is building millions of AM radios, and they have a, you know, they can only sell a few transmitters to a few radio stations. So from that moment onward, AT&T hated David Sarnoff, and they were the two biggest communications powerhouses in America, and it really, their contentious relationship lasted well into the 1960s.
Well, you've talked a little bit about the difference between AM and FM. What about, you know, nowadays, you know, people don't have any idea, but, you know, they don't even turn, I mean, you know, people still do that thing where they move their hand as though they're turning a dial, which that doesn't even happen anymore. People just use their various remotes that they have all laid out in front of them. But what about VHF, UHF, cable?
Well, so those were, VHF and UHF were the kind of classic examples of how the FCC did a terrible job managing the airwaves in the 20th century. Because they first, in 1945, after the war, created 13 channels. It was going to be, the dial was going to be from 1 to 13, and then they gave away channel 1, so VHF dials were from 2 to 13, and they said this would create 400-some stations around the country. Armstrong and a bunch of people said that's never going to work. Long story short, it leads to a system in which there's one, two, maybe three TV stations in most towns, and those stations all make a fortune. It was far fewer stations than we could have had. There was this one technology I love called Stratovision, and the idea was to take bombers from World War II and kind of create a 1950s version of satellite television where you would beam the TV signal up to the bomber and it would beam it down to eight states, I think it could cover. They did this in 1948 for the Republican convention. It worked great, but that would have allowed for a dozen television stations on a regional basis all over the country, each of which would have made far less in profit. So that didn't happen, and instead we get VHF and UHF, which was just an abominable technological failure. And so there were all these interesting technologies that were sidelined because they would have increased competition and increased choice in media for the American public.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. My guest is Scott Woolley. We're discussing his new book, The Network: The Battle for the Airwaves and the Birth of the Communications Age. I can remember when I was a kid, we had like four stations, and they often had advertisements warning against pay TV and how pay TV would be the end of the world if they ever had it. And, of course, that's what the world is all made of now.
Well, it was funny. We think of the cable industry as all-powerful. In the 60s, and we also think of them as not very well-liked, in the 1960s, when all you had were, a couple TV channels in your town, when Comcast first started up and they offered to lay a wire and then import remote signals, everybody thought the cable companies were the best thing ever. And so what did the FCC do? They passed regulations eliminating any new cable systems in the late 60s because they wanted to promote UHF stations, and they said that UHF wouldn't thrive if they let cable exist. So they got that technology completely wrong once again, and of course eventually cable sort of proved its merit. But it's funny that there was this period in which, you know, people were begging for new cable systems, and the government was just saying, no, we have to stick with UHF.
How much actual broadcasting still exists?
It depends how you define it. I mean, if you look at UHF stations, and there's this big auction going on right now in Washington to try to return a lot of the UHF TV airwaves to more modern purposes. So instead of TV signals that no one watches, it'll be, you know, more capacity for our smartphones that we desperately need. And a lot of these TV signals on UHF, they're only there because there's a law that says if you broadcast these signals, then the cable systems in the city must carry your signal. So the vast majority of people watch these broadcast signals either through satellite or cable. So we have a very cockeyed system that's based on the way the airwaves were given away in the 20th century, and it makes no sense.
So there are stations broadcasting, but no one is actually watching those broadcasts?
Very few. I mean, there's the latest numbers that I saw were something like 85% of Americans have access to pay television, so a good chunk of the rest are definitely watching over rabbit ears, maybe occasionally. But in terms of it being an efficient way in the 21st century of delivering television to homes, it's just not. In England, for instance, they have one satellite that covers the entire country. It would take two to cover the entire United States. But in England, they can, or in the United Kingdom, they can do it with one. And so they get their free TV. It's 40 channels of free TV. And if you want to get pay TV on top of that, you can. But they do it one satellite, serves the whole country. We have this weird system where we still have a bunch of local stations that broadcast signals that no one watches so that everyone can pay for cable. It's, as I say, not the most sensible system that we'll wound up with.
Can you speculate, Scott Woolley, how much longer will there be an NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox?
In terms of there being companies that derive their value the way they did in the 20th century, when it was basically the control over a scarce communications channel, there just weren't that many ways of moving a TV signal to American public's houses in the 20th century. So if you controlled one of them, that was had huge value. Now, in this world of over-the-top and Netflix and YouTube, the fact that you can deliver a video to a million American homes is no longer such a big deal. And so these companies exist as content brands. They have a lot of value in terms of what people think of, in terms of a CBS show and why they want to watch it, but the value now comes purely from the content as opposed to the conduit, if you will, in the 20th century, because the ability to move information is just so cheap, it's not a competitive advantage anymore.
And I guess they can't sell advertising like they used to.
That's absolutely true, because they don't control the user experience and the user interface in the way they used to. It's much easier to skip ads. It used to be you had to watch on, if you wanted to watch a CBS program, you watched it on their schedule, and if you wanted to skip an ad, it was only because you had to go out of the room and you better be back before it started. So that shift in power has been absolutely dramatic, and I think it's resulted in a lot of pretty good television being created.
Yeah, I know. It's a kind of a golden age of television, and maybe the line between television and motion pictures is no longer what it used to be.
Absolutely. That the diversity in content is only possible because of these radical increases in communication capacity that we've experienced and are continuing to experience. So the hold of companies, even a Comcast today, you know, they derive a lot of their power from controlling this last mile, the connection between your house and kind of the main internet. It's going to be really hard for them to hold on to that as technology continues to improve.
Scott Woolley, what are you going to do next? You've written this, now you've written a lot, but this is your first book, right?
It is. So I have a few ideas. I'm working on some magazine pieces about the spectrum auction that's going on right now. There's a lot of kind of strange things in this roughly $50 billion in airwaves that the government is going to be selling. So it's an amazing natural resource, these waves in the air. And if you look on Verizon's balance sheet, their airwaves alone are worth $70 billion. Globally, the airwaves are worth in the trillions of dollars. So covering what's going on with this natural resource that nobody can see and nobody can touch is almost always a good source of stories because it's so fundamental to our daily lives and yet so poorly understood.
There's some great stories in this book, The Network, The Battle for the Airwaves and the Birth of the Communications Age. and the author, my guest, Scott Woolley. Thanks so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thanks a lot. It's been a real pleasure.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll come back and see us again next week. I want to thank my guest, Scott Woolley. His book, The Network, The Battle for the Airwaves and the Birth of the Communications Age. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. You can find us each week at www.fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.